This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. When Durham native Victoria Lee wrote their first novel, they wanted to explore our habit of repeating our mistakes. It wasn't meant to be topical, but then the coronavirus pandemic happened, and Lee's fantasy science fiction YA book, The Fever King, now feels more familiar. The book has since been adapted for Webtoon, a digital storytelling platform centered on webcomics. More than 350,000 subscribers read weekly updates of The Fever King on Webtoon. And Victoria is with me now on The State of Things. Victoria Lee, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hey, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. You're from Durham, and you chose to set the story in a fictionalized future Durham. What is it about this place that made you think it's a perfect setting for your story?
Well, honestly, growing up, I loved reading fantasy, but it felt like all the books I read were either set in Europe or they were set in some fantasy version of Europe or maybe in New England if it was in the U.S. And I felt like there's so much magic that's endemic to the South and especially to Durham. There's so much history there. And so I wanted to write a book that capitalized on some of the magic that I felt like existed in Durham and in North Carolina.
Tell us about your main characters, Noam and Dara in particular, and how they embody particularly the economic divide that you would find here in Durham.
So Noam is the child of undocumented immigrants. So the book's set in this speculative North Carolina where magic's a virus and it usually kills you, and if you survive, you can use magic, right? His parents are from Atlanta, which is a neighboring country that's essentially Georgia, Alabama, that area, where the magic outbreaks have been quite severe. And so his family fled Atlanta to come to Carolina, and they are experiencing a lot of xenophobic hatred because people in Carolina are afraid that the refugees from Atlanta bring the virus with them and are an infection risk. Meanwhile, Dara is the son of the Minister of Defense of Carolina, so he's in this quite privileged, quite empowered position. And, you know, his adoptive father, Calix Lehrer, founded Carolina. He's like an immortal. He's really old and is, you know, extremely powerful and extremely famous. So they come from these very different backgrounds and they have very different goals and for the future of Carolina, as well as for how to handle the immigrant issue. And a lot of the book kind of follows how they're opinions diverge and intersect, and the things that they're each willing to do in order to accomplish their goals.
All right, and tell us about the virus at the center of your pandemic. It's an example of that which doesn't kill you makes you magic, right?
Yeah, essentially. So it's a virus that's very loosely based off Ebola in terms of the symptoms and the contagion risk. And almost everyone who catches this virus dies, but the ones who do survive end up getting magic, and usually you get some kind of magic that's related to something that you already could do well. So the main character is a hacker, and he's very interested in like programming and computer science. And so his power that he develops is the ability to control technology with his mind.
That's a good thing to have, and it allows him not only to survive, but again, as you say, to thrive and flourish. However, those talents bring him to the attention of those who are in power trying to get rid of this thing, and that creates a conflict for him.
Right. So in Carolina, it's the only country in the world that supports magic users or that allows them to live freely. Other countries are very afraid of them, both because of what they can do. Like, there are stories of these magic users accidentally decimating whole cities. But in Carolina, it was formed essentially after a genocide of magic users in the book's past, which is our present. And so magic users in Carolina are often inducted into the government or into like the higher echelons of society. And so Noam, when he survives the virus and gets magic, he gets the attention of Lehrer, Calix Lehrer, the Minister of Defense, Dara's adopted father, and is brought into this magic military training program where they're teaching him how to use his magic and also how to learn other different magic powers. And he hopes that he can use everything that they teach him there to bring down the government from the inside. But the longer he's there, the more complicated things get, and the more he starts to realize that who he can trust is a very complicated question.
So we're in the middle of a pandemic right now, as you know. Luckily, perhaps not a magic one, but still your story feels so much more topical now than it did when it was first released. And I wonder what it's been like for you to watch the world and its themes converge with your novel.
It's a little terrifying, to be honest. I mean, this book came out on March 17th, which was right when things were starting to really ramp up in the U.S. And I was in New York at the time, and everything shut down while I was there for my book release. And it was definitely scary. In some ways, I feel as if the book is about history repeating itself, right? Like, it's about how one of the characters, his grandparents survived the Holocaust, and then he survived the genocide of magic users, and then now there's what's going on now with the refugee conflict. And so it's trying to demonstrate, or the book is trying to demonstrate, the way that we don't learn from history's mistakes, and we perpetuate the same harms and the same violence upon people over and over in this cyclical way. And, you know, the immigration dilemma became really prescient around the time that my first book came out. And in the second book had the pandemic. And a part of me feels like, oh, should we, maybe we should have predicted this pandemic would happen, or predicted that we would need to have a better, stronger response to it, which I feel like isn't completely wrong to say, considering, you know, we had a pandemic response team from the Obama administration that got disbanded. And so,
A lot of the research that we were doing also got sort of scuttled because of a lack of interest in science over the past 4 years. So there's a lot that's been going on. But then it goes back even farther than that. You've got a health care system in this country that is based primarily on profit. And so when there's a crisis, like a public health crisis like this, it turns out it's not prepared. And so there's a lot in your book that wasn't future-looking at all. Not only that, xenophobia, racism, and the class divide. So the themes that you're dealing with, it seems to me, were very much with us in the moment. All we needed was the pandemic that was lurking and waiting for this moment to seize us. And tell me more.
I hope the rest of the book doesn't come true.
Well, I mean, a lot of it already has. Again, we talked about class divide. We've talked about xenophobia. Yeah. I mean, all those things are already there. I think that's part of what I'm getting to. Let me ask you, would you read from the book for us and give us a sense of kind of what's going on?
Yeah, sure. I'll read just from the beginning, from chapter one. Outbreaks of magic started all kinds of ways. Maybe a tank coming in from the quarantine zone didn't get hosed down properly. Maybe, like some people said, the refugees brought it up with them from Atlantia, the virus hiding out in someone's blood or in a juicy peach pie. But when magic infected the slums of West Durham and the proud sovereign nation of Carolina, it didn't matter how it got there. Everybody still died. Noam was ringing up Mrs. Ellis's snuff tins when he nearly toppled into the cash register. He all but had to fight her off as she tried to force him down into a folding chair. Swore he just got a touch dizzy, but he'd be fine, really. Go on home. She left eventually, and he went to stand in front of the window fan for a while, holding his shirt off his sweat-sticky back and trying not to pass out. He spent the rest of his shift reading Bulgakov under the counter. He felt just fine. That evening, he locked the doors, pulled chicken wire over the windows, and took a new route to the migrant center. In this neighborhood, you had to if you didn't want to get robbed. Once upon a time, or so Noam had heard, there had been a textile mill here. The street would have been full of workers heading home, empty lunch pails in hand. Then the mill had gone down and apartments went up, and by the 1960s, Ninth Street had been repopulated by rich university students with their leather satchels and clove cigarettes. All that was before the city got bombed halfway to hell in the catastrophe, of course. Noam's ex used to call it the Ninth Circle. She meant it in Dante's sense. The catastrophe was last century, though. Now the university campus blocked the area in from the east, elegant stone walls keeping out the riffraff, while Ninth and Broad crumbled under the weight of five-person refugee families crammed into one-room apartments, black markets buried in basements, laundry lines strung between windows like market lights. Sure, maybe you didn't want to wander around the neighborhood at night draped in diamonds, but Noam likes it anyway.
That's Victoria Lee reading from their novel, The Fever King, a YA novel, and a Durham author who is known to the world now because your book is out there. Talk more about this idea, which I find fascinating, that for those who survive, that 1%, it unlocks a kind of a magic. The suggestion is the magic has been there all along, and that this virus has in one way or another activated or perhaps amplified a power that's always been there. Talk about that theme and sort of how you see that playing out in terms of learning our lessons.
Well, technically, in terms of like the world building, the virus is the magic. So getting infected with it is what gives you the ability, and then your antibodies are essentially what keeps you from dying. But I would say that I still think that your statement's somewhat true, in that you know, a virus can infect absolutely anyone. In some ways, it's an equalizer, and it can. So in this case, the magic can be something that anyone from any social stratum can acquire. Although I do think that there's still like a class element there, because the people who are more likely to survive the virus, even in the Fever King universe, are the people who can afford better healthcare, and the people who come from backgrounds that kind of set them up for success and set them up for survival. So yes, it's something that everyone could theoretically be able to get if they were lucky enough.
Right.
But there are certain things about your life or your background that make you more likely to succeed, that just set you up for success from the beginning, that have nothing to do with you.
And whatever background you came from, you're likely in your novel to be co-opted by that power structure to work in its service, so that you're not necessarily free to transform
right.
society, but again, to constantly be refolded into it so that it can reproduce itself. It's kind of
yeah.
ingenious. Now, there's some other themes I want to get to before we close out, because I know there's the importance of Jewish history and your own past in terms of plotting the Fever King.
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that one of the things that was important for me to try to draw out in terms of themes in the book was this idea of history repeating itself. And although the conflict, the immigrant conflict at the center of the Fever King, has become quite relevant and has always been relevant for a number of groups, it was originally inspired by Jewish history and the ways in which we kind of identify groups to be scapegoats for problems in society, or we expect groups to do things that are frowned upon and then punish them for doing them. So with Jews, for example, in historical Europe, Gentiles didn't want to handle money. They considered it to be sinful to handle money. And so Jews would be bankers, or they would be tax collectors and moneylenders. So they would be in these careers involving money and involving distributing and collecting money. And then in times of economic hardship, they would, of course, be blamed for that economic hardship, for being greedy and all these other Jewish stereotypes. So you kind of created this right. self-fulfilling prophecy of persecution and discrimination, that I wanted to mirror that in the Fever King with the attitude toward the Atlanteans and also historically in Carolinia toward magic users.
Another important theme in the Fever King is surviving sexual abuse as a child. Share with us why you thought that was so important.
Yeah, so I am a sexual abuse survivor, a childhood sexual abuse survivor. And I wanted to write a book that looked at surviving abuse and recovering from abuse, not after the abuse is already finished. I feel like there are a lot of books that deal with, okay, how do you move on? How do you construct a new life and a new identity in the wake of sexual abuse or sexual assault? But not quite as much about how do you survive it while it's ongoing, and what narratives do you construct for yourself, and what stories do you tell yourself to make it survivable. So I wanted to write a book that would speak to teens especially who are currently surviving and who might be trying to justify their abuser's behavior to themselves, or who are buying into the gaslighting that their abuser is spitting out and believing like, oh, it's me, it's my fault, it's because I'm an addict, or it's because I'm promiscuous, or it's because I'm too anxious and fragile, which of course are all things that the abuser has created in them. I wanted to write about those narratives, but also about what it means to be the right kind of victim or the wrong kind of victim,
right.
and the ways in which we kind of expect sexual abuse victims to fall into a certain stereotypic mold of being very like sad or fragile or sex averse, and then victims who aren't those things. So victims who engage in maladaptive coping mechanisms like drugs and alcohol or promiscuity get punished for that and get told like, oh, well, you know, you must have deserved it, or you couldn't really have survived this because you don't fit into my expectation. So I wanted to write to those kinds of victims as well.
Talk about the change in platforms. You wrote a novel, but then it made it to Webtoon, which is a kind of graphic novel app that you can access in multiple platforms. What was it like? Talk about adapting your novel to Webtoon.
Yeah, so when they first approached me, I remember I was extremely excited. I am a huge comics nerd. I loved X-Men. I loved Japanese manga growing up. So I liked the idea of having a graphic representation of my book. I think especially because people enjoy media and like enjoy consuming stories. There's so many different types of media, whether it's TV or comics, graphic novels, books. And I wanted to be able to reach another audience, the kind of audience that might not, you know, pick up the book or might find, you know, reading a really thick sci-fi book quite intimidating. So I was super excited about it, and it's been a great experience.
You've been interacting with your fans?
Oh, yeah. I love talking to readers more than anything in the world, and I think that since Webtoon started, there's been a huge influx of new readers, both Webtoon-only readers and Webtoon readers who then picked up the book and have read the whole series now. And it's super fun getting tagged in like their fan art or fan fiction and their theories about the book and the characters. It's a lot of fun.
Victoria, great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Victoria Lee is the author of the YA fantasy novel in the Fever Wake series. It includes The Fever King and The Electric Heir, as well as the author of the Fever King Webtoon series is Victoria. And you can follow them on Instagram at So Said Victoria. And, of course, you can find out all of that at our website, stateofthings.org, a program that is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hullab-Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Josie Taras is our intern. Jenny Lawson, our technical director. Al Wodarski also helped engineer the show today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.